Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Men's Monday. Every man has lived his own life and has his own story to tell. Today's guest is no different. I'm very pleased to introduce you to Jim Brown. Jim is a media professional with many years of experience working across media platforms. Jim Brown, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Now, Jim, I'd like to start with asking you where you were born and to describe what life was like for you during that time.
I was born in a small town in North Carolina, northeast part of the state. It's a small town inland from the Outer Banks of people know more about the Outer Banks of North Carolina than they do about this particular town. But I grew up with my mother, father, and brother, and a sister. And later on in life, there was another brother, and he was much younger than we were. My parents actually waited about 10, 15 years before they had another child. A very happy life. We were poor, but I didn't know that. I was provided with all the things that I thought I needed at that time.
So you grew up in a household, an intact family, which, as we know in today's world, is, you know, to some extent unusual. Mom, dad, brothers, sisters, what was life like for you during that time? You are an African-American male growing up in an African-American household. What was going on in the world as you were a little one?
Well, growing up, I would hear things like there was a war going on, and my family wasn't directly involved in any of that, but they talked about it. I knew that in the far distance, I had cousins and uncles and so forth who were going into the war and coming out. And I knew also that had just come out of a recession, and that things were still very, very scarce, and material things were not that plentiful. But we were kept happy, in a sense. The Korean War was just ending when I was about maybe 4 or 5 years old, and my uncles and families were coming home from the war and being greeted and so forth, and I was able to observe that, and also was able to observe a lot of the effects that that the war had had on people. I didn't understand them then, but as I grew older, thinking back, I realized how devastating it was to their lives and to many of the lives of my family members.
We certainly know that there was a period, in particular with the Vietnam War, where many times when people came back, they were not greeted as kindly and as welcoming and as respectful as they are today. What was it like for your family members as they were coming back from the war? How were they greeted by the outside world? Did you have a sense of that?
Yes, I did. It was a little bit different than the Vietnam War, but it still had the same effect. When my family members would come home and they would walk around in their uniform, they were getting a great deal of respect from other African-American people, black folks around in the communities where I grew up. But I, just observing as they walked, say, downtown and so forth, I could see a difference in respect from white people than there were from black people. Black people were, like, proud to be near or knowing someone who had a uniform on. It was the uniform meant something to the people back then. So much so till I had, in my little mind, say maybe 5 or 6 years old, I could see myself in a uniform as well. I I didn't learn later what war was all about until I grew up. But back then, they were heroes for me.
And you said that they were greeted and treated well by African American family, friends, neighbors, strangers, but differently by non-African American folks. How were they treated differently?
Treated as if they had never been away. They still could not. There was a local drugstore or place in town where you could get sodas and so forth. You could walk in, get a fountain drink or soda, but you had to step out to drink it. You couldn't sit at the counter. That was one of the things that I noticed as a little boy. Even one time I remember going into the store myself with my mother, and she ordered a couple of Cokes, and I sat at the counter, and it devastated her. She wanted me to get off the counter and get away from the counter right quick, and I didn't like that. I understood it, but I didn't like it. I didn't like the fact that I couldn't sit down and have a soda, and I noticed that people with military uniforms on and so forth would go in, and they have to do the same thing. They couldn't sit down either.
So the color of skin was much more important than the uniform, the service, the life experiences.
To the white folks in my neighborhood, yes.
And how long did you live in your neighborhood? Did you stay there throughout your childhood? What was school like? Friends, family? What was going on?
Stayed in throughout my school life, throughout high school. It was quite subdued, small country town where the white folks stayed to themselves. The black folks stayed to themselves. You could see some intermingling and so forth, and you could even see some white folks sneaking into the neighborhood to try and date and secretly date other women. It was a county type. The area was divided into a county, two counties. They had a county where we went to school. There were like one elementary school and one what we called then high school. And we had to travel from our house, which is about 20 miles or so, to a high school. And I traveled on the bus every morning. We passed right by two elementary schools and two high schools to get to the school in the upper part of the county where I went to school.
And what county did you live in, and what county did you go to school in?
It was called Northampton County.
Okay.
And in Northampton County, there were at that time there was one elementary school and one high school.
And this was Northampton County, Virginia.
In Virginia, yes.
Okay. And as a youngster traveling all that way to school, did you and your friends talk about what you were confronted with clearly as a result purely of your skin color and nothing else?
We weren't conscious enough to talk about the school itself in that sense, but it was obvious that when the county got new school buses, all the new school buses went to the white folks, and we were riding in an old what I call dilapidated bus that we didn't know whether they were going to make it to school sometime or not. But the new buses always went to the white folks, and the older buses were handed down to black folks. We also noticed that the condition of the books and so forth that our materials in the school that we received were, in a lot of cases, books and materials that looked like hand-me-downs. And I didn't particularly like it, but I could see it. But we never really had discussions about it.
And with your family, did your parents talk to you about it?
No.
Okay. So what were their expectations of you as you were going to school and growing up? Did they share with you their sense of what your job should be and even what your schooling experiences should be?
They mostly wanted us to, and I say us, I mean me, my brothers and so forth, they wanted us to stay in school, get a good education, and not be involved in any of the negative things that were going on in the community. You go to church every Sunday, and after church you could play sports and so forth, but you would not hang out after dark anywhere in town.
Why? What was going on in town?
Well, you know, in those days, a lot of things was going on that we didn't know about because we didn't get exposed to them. But there were a lot of places where people could hang out and clubs and so forth, where people could go and dance and do things, and we wouldn't get involved in them. I didn't get involved in a lot of the things until I was in high school.
Okay, and you had two brothers. Ultimately, you had two brothers and one sister.
Mm-hmm.
Were the expectations for your brothers different from the expectation for your sister?
No.
Okay.
We all were expected to prepare ourselves to live good, wholesome lives. That's what they wanted from us. And for that reason, we were highly respected in the neighborhood. People even today, people still talk about the Browns and what a good family we appear to be from the outside.
And were you a good family?
I think so.
Okay. And what was good, wholesome? Sounds like that looked like go to school, go home, do your homework, don't hang out after dark. Was there more to that sort of cloak of good, wholesome that was important for your parents? The expectations that your mom and dad had for you as a young African-American man in those days, what was it? Was it to, it sounds like certainly school was very important. Was it to go beyond high school? Was it to work? What kind of work was it that they anticipated you would do?
Neither of my parents were educated, so the goal they had for me was to make sure I finished high school and do whatever I needed to do to have a good life for myself. My father was a kind of guy who when he was home, he always had a Bible around. He always talked about the Bible. He could remember and quote scripture from the Bible all the way through. He allowed us to do whatever we wanted to do in terms of sports and so forth. He loved sports. He loved to see us play sports. But he wanted us to just be people who grew up, who would be kind to other people. He demonstrated that by being kind to other people. My mother used to always argue with him about giving away things. He would give his time, his materials and so forth to other people if he felt they needed it. You know, they'd come by. People would come to the house just to borrow things and to get things from us. And we witnessed him doing that. And my mother as well, she would argue with him about doing it, but she did it herself too. So it was always, they wanted us to be respected by people. And they felt respect was people who didn't drink alcohol, who didn't curse, who didn't do the kind of things that in their minds were ill things that good folks just don't do.
Gotcha.
Most of what my parents looked at was the values that they brought to us from their childhood. they had witnessed a lot of things that they would talk to us about in their childhood that they did not want to happen to us.
Such as
the majority of, I shouldn't say the majority, but a lot of folks in my family, older folks in my family were alcoholics, and they were, when I say alcoholics, they were functional alcoholics who my father didn't want us to act out any of the things that we saw those adults doing. We could see them because they would come to visit, and we know that they were get drunk and talk, you know, and say things. And my father protected us in a way that he wouldn't allow any profanity to be used in the house or wherever. My father was also a barber. He on the front porch, he would cut hair on the weekends, and the guys who came by to get their haircuts and so forth were not able to have the kind of discussion they normally would have in a barbershop because my father wouldn't allow it.
Interesting. And what about your mom? It sounds like your mom was pretty busy with child care and household care.
She was. She didn't get too much into conversations with them. In fact, in those days, the women were in one corner talking and the men were in another corner talking or in another room talking. So it was usually women having what we call today girl talk and men having men talk.
Gotcha.
It wasn't one of those things where they all sat in the same place and have the kind of discussions that you see today.
So your mom had the glorious experience of being a stay-at-home mom, taking care of her kids, taking care of her household, and that was it.
Well, no, they both worked. There were times when both parents were away from home, especially during the day. And as we got older, the only time we would see our parents was at home in the evening, say 4 or 5 o'clock in the evening when we all get home from school. Then they both were there. But most of the time when I was much smaller, my mother would either take me and my sister and brother somewhere near where she was, and we would wait in the area or in the car or whatever while she worked. But it was not, we would never actually ever, not during my time, taken care of by anyone else other than my mother.
Interesting. And what kind of work did Mom do?
Mom did a variety of work. She did factory work. She did what do you call it, domestic work, and other things. But she never was in a situation where she had to leave us for long periods of time alone.
I see. The expectations that your mom and dad had for you as a young African-American man in those days, what was it? Was it to, it sounds like certainly school was very important. Was it to go beyond high school? Was it to work? What kind of work was it that they anticipated you would do?
Neither of my parents were educated. So the goal they had for me was to make sure I finished high school and do whatever I needed to do to have a good life for myself. And even though they couldn't afford it, for them, education was a must. Find a way to get an education. That's what they all would always say. And have a life that was better than what they had. They wanted us to do whatever we wanted to do, but make sure that we stayed connected to what they call the right things in life. My father always said, keep both feet on the ground so that you can always anchor yourself to grow and do whatever you need to do. He loved to see us play sports. But he wanted us to just be people who grew up, who would be kind to other people. He demonstrated that by being kind to other people. My mother used to always argue with him about giving away things. He would give his time, his materials, and so forth to other people if he felt they needed it. You know, they'd come by. People would come to the house just to borrow things and to get things from us. And we would witness him doing that. And my mother as well. She would argue with him about doing it, but she did it herself too. So it was always, they wanted us to be respected by people. And they felt respect was people who didn't drink alcohol, who didn't curse, who didn't do the kind of things that in their minds were ill things that good folks just don't do.
Gotcha. There came a time, clearly, when you left home, you left Northampton County, you left Virginia, and you moved where?
Right after high school, I had the intention of going to college, so I enrolled in a college in Norfolk, Virginia. It's now called Norfolk State, but then it was called Little State. I enrolled in school there, and I had cousins who lived right in the neighborhood where the school was, and I lived with them for a while I was in school. Having not all of the financial resources I needed to stay there, I looked to get to work, and I did work for a while in restaurants and so forth to support myself. But I eventually left there and went to New York, where I worked and went to school for many years there in New York.
That sounds like a big change from Northampton County in Virginia and surrounding parts of Virginia to the big old New York, and possibly New York City, I'm not sure. But I tell you what, Jim Brown, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue and we'll pick you up in New York. Folks, don't go away. This is just before the break, you were headed to New York. Tell us where in New York you landed and what that was like.
Well, our whole family were very close, and that we visited and talked to each other all the time. And I had a cousin in New York who I knew, in my opinion, whenever he was come down to visit, he would always be dressed fine, and he'd have a fancy car and all that stuff. And he was an impressive person for me. I was impressed by him, and so he knew that I didn't like being down there, meaning in that neighborhood or in the town that I grew up in. It was a small town. And he knew that I wanted to get out of there. He invited me to come to New York to live with him. And I went to New York, and I actually took the bus from down there up to New York and got, when I came up out of the book, out of bus from the bus station in New York and came up, I started to almost choke because I was the just the feeling and the air in New York was like unnatural to me. And then when I got the subway and rode up to Harlem where he lived, came out of the sub, got come up the subway, it was very, very, I mean, I saw people laying in the street and winos and so forth, and it just, it was like, I wanted to go back home.
It certainly sounds like it would have been culture shock.
It was a culture shock for me.
And how old were you when you got to New York?
Oh, about 18, going on 19.
Okay, so really just a kid.
Yeah.
And the cousin that you lived with, who it sounds like in a lot of ways helped you change your entire life, what was that cousin's name?
His name, we called him Johnny Mac. And Johnny Mac was a very outspoken black man who was very strong, very direct. He knew everything that I needed to know in New York in terms of street life and so forth. And he was actually a construction worker. And he was the kind of guy who took care of his family well and had a well managed household, he and his wife. And it was he's the kind of guy who would take me out for walks around Harlem and point out things to me to let me know, this is what this guy, look, see the guy over there? He's doing this, he's doing that. And see the guy over there? He's selling drugs and so forth and so on. And this guy over there is this or that. He would point people out to me and what they were doing and all of the things that I should not be able to not get myself involved with. He was very astute in terms of understanding what the street life was like. He wasn't necessarily involved in it, but he had the knowledge, and it, without me knowing, he could have been involved in it earlier in life. I don't know, because he had been there for like, he lived in New York for like 40 years by the time I got there.
And do you remember the approximate year or year span in which you arrived at New York?
I got to New York at about 1960.
Okay, 1960. And so Harlem in New York in the 60s, how would you characterize it, just the whole experience?
It was Harlem. It was busy. There was a lot of music up and down 7th Avenue, Lenox Avenue, and so forth. There was a lot of people. There was a lot of people selling things, people buying things. Around 125th Street, there was a lot of activity, and I was able to see and witness a lot of the changing things that most folks talk about now in terms of culture in New York at that time. The whole period during the Civil Rights Movement, well, I already knew about the Civil Rights Movement from home because we were able to witness that from where I came from. We knew what was happening down south. At least I knew what was happening down south. And my cousin pointed out to me that there were places in New York where I could learn more about those kind of things than I would if I stayed home, to make sure that I got myself involved. So I would walk up and down 125th Street, and that was the first time I witnessed Doc Ben on the corner of 7th Avenue, and I mean 125th Street, out in the neighborhood talking, and I was beginning to learn things that I had never learned before. For instance, talking about African history and so forth, I got my first inclination or my first lesson on, say, Egypt from Dr. Ben.
We refer to him as Doc Ben, but we're talking about Dr. Yosef Ben Yochanan, who is one of the most referred to or most admired Afrocentric writers and historian in the world. That day he was talking about the African origin of Christianity, which took my little mind from the Bible into looking at other forms of history. You have to remember, this is the early 60s, and I'm a young kid out of high school, out of a southern high school, walking with the anger of Emmett Till still on my mind, and still remembering what had happened earlier in Alabama and Mississippi. So I was open for new knowledge and wanted to get a better understanding of what was going on.
It's interesting that you met on standing on the street corner someone who was in fact or became a noted historian. So Harlem was a really interesting experience for you. What were some of your early jobs? Were you still in college at that point, or were you working? What was going on?
I had a job during the day working at a restaurant downtown. And in the evening, I would get on a subway, come uptown to take classes at City College, and then spend the rest of the evening, if I had time, to explore Harlem. And I could hear the giants like Dizzy Gillespie and John Coltrane and Jackie McLean, you know, playing someplace in the area, which further enhanced my understanding and my appreciation of the music. And in later years, I actually met and spent some time with Dizzy Gillespie. I actually gave him a ride and a tour in my car, along with another friend of mine named Rodden Sutton, who many people in the Washington, D.C. area know as Big Ron Sutton, who used to be on various radio stations around the Washington, D.C. area. And then in later years, I actually met Jackie McLean and worked with him in Hartford, Connecticut. Just to hear the music and feel it was a very inspiring experience for me, which really introduced me to that part of our culture that I had not known before. Before then, the closest I got to understanding our music was the church music, and we knew about all of the rock and roll stuff that was going on because it was very prevalent during that time. But it wasn't something that really sunk into my soul until I was able to witness what these other folks were doing. I had the experience of hearing Dizzy in the late 50s in Norfolk, Virginia, but I did not know who he was and what he was about until I got to New York. So there was a whole area of education that I was able to acquire just by being in Harlem during that time.
At some point, you got involved in communications. How did that happen?
Well, at the age of 12 years old, I would watch television, and I would see, most of the time, my father loved Westerns, and he watched the fights, and he watched a lot of the stories on television, and I was sitting there watching with him, and I started to wonder, especially when there was a conversation where two people were at a table talking, and you could see a close-up of one of the people, and then a reverse angle of person, and I was trying to figure out at the age of 12, how in the heck do they do that? Why don't I see the camera that's taking this guy's picture when they do a reverse angle? And I wanted to figure out how that was done. So there weren't a lot of books around, but every time I would go to the library, I would find myself in the area looking at books on movies or photography or whatever to find out exactly how that was done. And so interested in it that I felt that one of the things that I was going to do after I became a doctor, because I wanted to be a doctor at one point in my life too.
A doctor of what?
A medical doctor.
Okay.
And I didn't know exactly what I was going to specialize in, but I just wanted to be a doctor because they seemed to be the most respected people in my neighborhood. So I went to the library and I started to look at books on photography and so forth. So when I left home and got to look for jobs and so forth, I started looking for jobs of that would give me some more experience in film and television. And I ran across a company that, in fact, my first 3 years in New York, I would go through the Yellow Pages looking for different jobs and so forth, and had this one-page resume with just about two paragraphs on it, poorly written. But I would send these to everyone I could think of from the Yellow Pages. And about 2.5 years after doing that, I got a call from a small film production company in New York. This, you got to talk now about somewhere around 60, about 60, 65, 66, somewhere around there. And the company asked if I was still interested in learning about film. And it shocked me because I'd gone like 3 years sending these pages out every week, mailing them out, spending money on stamps and so forth, sending them out, and get this one response after all that time. And I jumped on it and went down to interview with these folks, and they was a small industrial film company, and I got a job with them.
What was the name of that company?
That was called Henry Strauss Productions. It was Henry Strauss was a guy who had done a lot of things already in film and so forth, and he was very active in making films for training films for some of the large corporate companies like Pan American and IBM and a lot of, I don't need to mention them all now, but those large companies like that he was doing films for.
And so what was your job with him?
I came in as a production assistant, and the first guy he assigned me to work with was a guy who was also very experienced in film and production and so forth. He had worked in Hollywood. He had worked in many different areas of film, and he was very knowledgeable, and he was very given in terms of teaching and giving me opportunities to learn. And so I learned a lot about the industry.
Do you remember his name?
Yeah, his name was Walter Rothschild.
Walter Rothschild. Rothschild is kind of a familiar name.
Of the Rothschild.
Oh, my.
Okay.
Okay, so he was not broke?
No.
Okay. How long did you stay there?
I was there for 7 years.
It sounds like it would have been completely exciting for you. Were you one of one in terms of persons of color, or was it well integrated?
Well, it was not well integrated at all. There was two people there, me and another young lady who worked as a secretary in that in the office.
Okay.
Okay.
And when you left there 7 years later, what did you do at that point?
Well, during the time I worked there, I said to you that I went downtown. I worked during the day, and then in the evening I would come uptown. And I got involved with as many community folks as possible. And I ended up working with, through associations, working with a group of guys who were at that time starting to train black people in the various aspects of film and media. And
who were some of these people?
Oh, God, they were. You had people like, there's a guy who actually introduced me to the group of young men who were working at that time. One of the guys was named Sinclair Bourne, who's a very, very good, he proved to be a very good friend of mine. And then there's another guy named Stan Lathan, who's now a huge director in Hollywood. People like Roland Mitchell, who was a great sound man at that time, and a lot of other folks whose name escapes me right now, but they were all folks who knew the industry and were able to help me further develop my skills.
And as you were developing your skills, did you work in commercial environments? I mean, I understand that doing community work was important to you, so giving back seems like it was sort of part of your family legacy as you talk about your mom and your dad. Did you transfer that experience into your media work?
My whole life turned out, as I look back on it, at doing those kinds of things. One of the first things I remember getting involved with was a school that was just developing at WNET. This is in the late 60s. There's a school.
And that was WNET TV?
WNET TV.
In New York.
In New York.
Okay.
There was a school that was started by, then her name was Miss Peggy Penn. She started the NET TV training school. And Roland Mitchell was one of the people who introduced me to Peggy and to that school. And I went there and I taught for a while there. And after that, I got involved with another young man in New York by the name of Cliff Fraser. And he was introduced to me by another friend that I met in the industry called Bill Husson. Actually introduced me to Bill Husson was a writer, very talkative guy, very energetic guy. He introduced me to Cliff Fraser, and Cliff was organizing or directing the Community Film Workshop Council at that time. And he wanted me to come in and work with him. Now, during this time, was toward the end of my career with the Henry Strauss Company, but people knew of me because they knew that I had was working in the industry, and that I had worked with a lot of folks who had been involved in some very major productions around New York, and they knew that I had worked on those projects, so they wanted me to share my experience and so forth with people that they know, because at that time we were trying to build as many competent young men in the industry as possible. There were a lot of things that were rolling off the table at that time. One of the things that happened was the making of a film called Cotton Comes to Harlem that was directed by Ossie Davis. And that was one of the things that I wanted to work with, but I wasn't in the circle that would give me the access or the opportunity to meet the people in the crew who would hire me.
Jim, we're gonna take a break, and when we come back, let's pick up with Ossie Davis. I'd love to know if you ever did meet Ossie Davis. So, folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk Men's Monday on Mind Talk. We'll be right back. Jim, before the break, you were talking about your wish to work on Cotton Comes to Harlem, which is sort of one of those iconic films, I think, that, you know, folks certainly have lots of different views on, but I think many people know the name of that film. Did you ever work on that film? You wanted to. You wanted to meet Ossie Davis. What happened?
What happened was I didn't actually work on the film, but I got the chance to meet Ossie Davis.
Okay.
Ossie was a good friend of Cliff Fraser's, and we ended up, when I say we, I mean we, the group of young men that I talked to you about earlier, like Roland and Stan and those folks, were people who shared the experience that we had with some a group of young men who were actually applying for jobs on that film. And
were these African-American men?
These all African-American men.
Okay.
Because what had happened, Ossie had actually stopped production of the film in Harlem because there were not enough black folks on it. And the reason they were given was because they couldn't find anybody, any experienced black people there. So Ossie stopped.
That's a familiar refrain.
Yeah. He stopped the production for the film for a while. And while these men... Because we said we could find the people, and Cliff was one of those people who said we could find enough people there to work. So a lot of the people that we trained at that time that were trained during that period got jobs on that production.
Ah.
Okay. So that was one of the things that we would do to fight what was going on at that time. And you talk people like even later in life... Came Tony Brown, who was the second executive producer of Black Journal.
Okay.
There were other folks on Black Journal that I had met during that time. Names escape me right quickly now, but there were people on Black Journal who were very instrumental in our development as well, because they gave us the opportunity to work on back in those days, a larger production than we would work on local stuff that would give us some more experience. It would broaden our horizon in terms of kind of things that we were doing. Because of the experience I had had before Tony Brown came to town, he asked if I would come on and actually sort of like as a counsel or help develop a production procedure for Black Journal, and I did that for him as a consultant, and in working with him, I was able to meet a lot of other folks. That's where I met Stan Latham.
Okay,
because Stan was working with Tony on Mind Talk,
no, Black Journal, right?
Yes, on Black Journal. Yeah. He was there. That's where I met him.
You mentioned Mind Talk, and certainly you have been with Mind Talk from its inception. But before we spend a couple seconds on that, at some point you left New York and wound up at Howard University. What were you doing at Howard University, and why did you go to Howard University?
Well, I was actually asked to come to Howard after Tony Brown became the first dean of the School of Communications at Howard.
I see.
I had actually left New York about 3 years earlier and gone to Hartford, Connecticut to operate and be the director of the Community Film Workshop up in Hartford, Connecticut. And up there we produced television programs and taught young community folks the experience and so forth with film, with television, with radio. We taught radio, film, and TV at this workshop, and trying to prepare people to work in the industry. And some of the people that we worked with in that time became prominent people in the industry and worked throughout the industry and are still working, a lot of them.
And, like who?
Let's see. Folks, a person that somebody might remember around here in this area is Dorothy Green, Dottie Green.
And you're talking about Washington, D.C. when you refer to this area. Okay.
Yes. It's Dottie Green, who's worked in the industry for all those years. But she actually got her start at the Community Film Workshop Council in Hartford.
Hmm.
But then jumping from there to Howard, Tony, when he got the idea of doing the school, of opening up the school at Howard, he called and asked if I could come and teach a couple of courses there. Well, by that time, I was doing pretty well in Hartford, and I wanted to, because I understood the significance of starting a school of communications at a major university and so forth, my ego was such that I wanted to be a part of that as well. I actually came in on the second semester to teach there.
Okay.
Okay. So the actual creation of the school happened, and I came in at the beginning stages of the school.
Okay.
As an instructor, and I taught there, but I was going to only be there for a year. And I came down because friends that I had known before, like Stan and Mitchell and other folks were people who said to me that that's where you need to be. And I took the job, came down, and the rest is history. Instead of going back to Hartford a year later, I stayed at Howard, and I actually worked for Howard for over 30 years.
All in the School of Communications?
All in the School of Communications. Huh. No, mostly in the School of Communications, and then the last 20 years or so, I worked with the Howard University's television station.
I see.
WHMM then, it's now called WHUT. I was there for many years too, as well.
And certainly somewhere along the road, you became involved with Mind Talk and became the producer of Mind Talk and have been since Mind Talk's inception. But I want to ask you about your sense of people of color in the media today. What is your sense? Do you see progress, lack of progress? Are you hopeful? Are you discouraged? Talk about that.
If you talk about television, I only see those programs that are milked down or milquetoast versions of what is acceptable to the white establishment. Programs that boost our true culture is usually feared by the white culture. They want people to think a certain way, feel a certain way, and act a certain way. Anything contrary to that, they consider it a threat. Whenever we get to a place where we can honestly do the programs that we need to do for ourselves, that's when I'll be satisfied. Black people who are working in this industry who don't have the full control of the stories that they tell are working in a handicapped situation. It's very difficult for the true story to get out if you can't find someone who will support it. So Mind Talk became a program that would allow me to do that, to produce what I consider to be programs that will help affect the minds of people and how they think about themselves and how they behave about themselves. It's very important to me. So, in other words, my purpose is trying to affect change in the minds of people. And to the degree that I can do that, the more satisfaction I get out of doing a program like Mind Talk.
Do you want to see more persons of color in the industry, or do you think it matters?
It's not the number of people that you see, but it's the number of people who are conscious enough to tell the stories that need to be told. that will elevate the consciousness of people of African descent.
You know, Jim, I know that there are many more parts of your story to be told, but we've only got an hour today. I know about many awards that you've gotten and folks well-known who you've worked with. So we may have you back for part two, but for part one, we're going to have to wrap it up. And I do want to thank you very much for joining us today and spending your time talking about your experiences. And, of course, I have to thank you for all the work you do with Mind Talk.
Thank you for having me.
And folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a licensed medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available on demand at myndtalk.org. That's myndtalk.org. If you'd like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. Best way to be in touch is by going through the website, which again is myndtalk.org. And of course, Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Folks, thank you very much for joining us today. And folks, remember always, if it's unacceptable, then that's what it is. Unacceptable. You take care.